We have two kids, and it would be beneficial for helping-wise if they were closer. They're not really close enough to help on a super regular basis. Our six-year anniversary is coming up in 2 weeks, and so Megan's mom is going to come and watch the kids so we can get away for a couple days. But, yeah, unfortunately, Megan's siblings, they all live in, like, a little commune down in Orlando. And so it's like, you know, our niece and nephew have all four grandparents there a couple blocks away that can just take a stroll down the road. We don't have that support system quite in place, but it's still good even from a distance.
Are they, I have maybe a not so nice question.
Uh-oh.
Are they Disney adults?
Well, my...
Is that fun?
Funny enough to answer your question, okay. Danielle.
Hello, movie lovers. I'm Danny.
And I'm Nick.
Welcome to In Love with Movies.
This is the podcast where we talk about what, Danny?
Love.
And?
Movies.
Oh, what do you know? What do you know? Each week we break down some film and...
Each week?
Each month. I keep trying to get you to do it each week.
Nope.
Nope. Yeah, so each month, once a month, every final Tuesday of the month, we break down a movie. But first, we talk about love. And typically, I've been having guests, and we get to have guests on to talk to us about their experiences with love, all kinds of love, romantic love, parental love, all of the above, and then some history that they have with a movie. Why are you trying to interrupt me? Am I talking too much?
No, I was going to make a joke, but it's past. And today we have a very special guest who I truly know nothing about, but he knows a lot about me. I'm so excited.
The beauty of social media. We are happy to be joined by Professor Dr. Ed Hansen. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. No, it really was just Nick and I started talking on Twitter. Like, after I followed you guys online, Danny, you asked, like, hey, what's your love story? And I said it was Young Frankenstein and why. And then I was just like, that would be really fun to talk about. And here we are.
And then I had heard you appear a couple of times on a podcast that is from a joint friend that I've also appeared on before. And he's appeared on our podcast by Dr. Alex Swan, the CinePsych podcast.
I'm surrounded by all these doctors.
All the doctors. They're all psychology people, though. We're not actually like medical doctors. Yeah, not real doctors.
Not real doctors. Not like Dr. Frankenstein.
Indeed.
Spoiler alert.
Indeed. Although his lecture, as he was delivering it, I was thinking to myself, I'm pretty sure I've given basically that lecture, because now it's like intro psychology when you're talking about the basics of neurology. Sorry, my brain is blanking on me. Neuroscience and those connections.
It's not my area of psychology either, so don't worry.
Yeah, not mine. I remember it. I actually started off as a neuroscience major, but yeah, it's that early stuff. It's that early stuff. So,
anyways, we're not talking about Frankenstein.
You're right.
Now.
You're right. We're talking about Ed. We are talking about Ed, but we should mention, for those of you who are watching us, you may notice that Ed is currently in black and white, and that is not a mistake. That is not a flaw of his camera. It is because we are going to later be discussing Frankenstein.
Young Frankenstein.
That's correct. I was going to let Ed say it.
Oh.
That's okay.
Oh. Say it, Ed.
It's pronounced Frankenstein.
Indeed. So Edwin impressively was able to figure out something for that bit, and we wanted to make sure that the listeners know about his commitment.
Yeah, there's a whole story about why they did it in black and white and how hard they worked to get it done in black and white, but we'll save that.
So. Perfect.
Love it. Love it. But first, we're going to talk about Ed. We're going to talk about his life in love. Right, Danny?
Yeah, Ed. So tell us, how's love?
Love is great.
Yeah.
My wife, Megan, and I have been married almost 6 years. Our anniversary is in 2 weeks, Memorial Day weekend, which I know won't match up with the airing of this episode. But yeah, we have two young children. We have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old boy. And we've got a lot of love in our life. It's good.
Cute.
Love
and
that.
You said that she's a Floridian. Is that why you're in Florida right now? Or tell us, how'd you meet her?
Yeah, I came to Florida in 2014 for a teaching job at Florida State University. And I was online dating to try and meet people because I quickly found that all of the people I was meeting through my coworkers and the people I was meeting at Florida, all these people had already been vetted and deemed undateable for one reason or another.
Oh. By you or by society?
By my acquaintances. Oh, okay. And so I was just thinking, yeah, I got to broaden my circles here. And so new state, new job, new everything. And fortunately for me, I met Megan online. Our connection was in November. So I only 3-4 months after I moved down here.
Oh, good.
We had one date in December, but it was right before Christmas break, which was kind of an awkward time.
Sure.
To keep that going, especially because I was going home to see my family in very rural Northeast Wisconsin. And I said, Megan, I don't really have good cell phone reception up there. We don't really have good internet up there. Like, this is when Facebook was more in vogue. So I was like, I think I need to be Facebook friends with you so we can stay in touch this way. And she and her friends were like, okay, you can like creep on my Facebook photos if that's what you really need to do. But then she came up, fast forward, August of the next year, and she was like, oh, you were not kidding.
I was going to ask how long it took for her to like see what that was like. Yeah.
Yeah. My family is from Door County, Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
Vacation destination.
Yes, we've been there
but,
a time or two.
Not known for its cell reception. So.
Yeah, it's known for its cherry wine, right?
Known for cherry wine. Known for all things cherry.
Yeah.
Yes, cherries.
Cherry wine, cherry pie, dried cherries, cherry pits. Got it all.
Cherry pits?
Cherry pits spit is a competition.
What?
Where you can see if you can spit it further than your competitor.
And how many times have you competed in the cherry pits spit?
Unofficially only. Never in an official competition. I've done some like backyard pit spits, nothing big.
You're not nationally ranked or anything like that. We don't need to add it to
No.
Well, that's okay. I can't believe you've never heard of a cherry pit spit before.
And from Chicago, we don't spit cherries, we spit at other people.
Well, it's funny. Both my folks are from Chicago, but Dad spent every summer as a kid up in Northeast Wisconsin, and he got his business degree, and his friends thought he was bananas for going up there, but he went up there and got a job out of Green Bay. Then he convinced Mom to come a few years later, and they actually met on a blind date through his brother. But the equivalent of online dating in 1979.
Well, let's hear more about that then, because we also know that you've got maybe some history with the movie we're going to be discussing, and this is going to kind of end up being our unofficial Father's Day episode. It's going to be coming out around that time. So let's hear more about your relationship with your dad and how your parents got to be to beget you.
Yeah, so like I said, he was living in Wisconsin. My mom was still living in Chicago, and he went down to visit his brother. My uncle, his brother, and my mom were teaching in the same school district. And so they decided to go out on like a double date with my aunt and uncle, my dad, and then my mom. And they met for the first time that night. And she was not much of a drinker, but was like getting the same drinks that they were getting. And
oh,
wasn't
dear.
Feeling well. There's a whole story about how they fell in love despite all of these things against the odds. It all worked out. And then they were married about a year after that. And all the stories I've ever heard about them, like going to the movies and stuff, and I've heard this from Mom, I've heard this from Dad. She would shush him in theaters for laughing too loud, and she has done this to me as well. If you get Dad and I in the same room, and we're watching a movie together, our laughs kind of just meld into one laugh, for sure. So I got a lot of my love for movies and especially comedy movies from him. Mom likes watching movies, but she does not love talking about movies. And that's something that she has in common with my wife, Megan. They'll watch movies with me, but once Dad and I start talking, they just leave the room.
I understand that. And that must be the academics in you both, because I'm like, cool, I saw it. All right. Bye.
Yeah, but the whole point of a movie is to experience it afterwards, to share your thoughts, to talk about how it moved you, to talk about what you saw coming, to talk about what surprised you.
That's fair. I think I need... you guys are just so smart. I can tell Ed by the way you talk and Nick by the way you talk. Well, I know you. You're very, very smart
I'm
people.
I'm smart?
And I need time to let it soak in, you know? Like, we watched this movie yesterday. I don't think it's going to soak in until you're talking about it later on. But yeah, Nick likes to have like little powwows after every movie, especially if it's like, you know, Marvel movie, especially on premiere night when it's 3 o'clock in the movie in the morning when the movie got out and he just wants to talk about Marvel. And I'm like, bro, we got to go to sleep. But anyways, that is something that you guys have in common is that deep discussion, that intellectual stimulation, I believe. That
I don't even know that it always has to be intellectual. Sometimes we just get excited.
Yeah. Yes.
So you are saying your favorite kinds of movies are comedies, or do you like thinkers?
I do like the full gamut, but comedies hold a very, very special place in my heart. I think, like, as much as I love movies in general, like, I know you're in improv, I consider myself a little bit more of a comedy nerd than I do a movie nerd. And so, like that, going to my relationship with my dad in movies, when I was a teenager, it can be a tough time to, like, bond, you know, with parents and children. But that was when the American Film Institute came out with, like, their list of the 100 best movies ever.
Oh, that was the first time AFI had done it? Okay.
We got that, yeah, the AFI list, and we got that newspaper clipping, and we were, like, highlighting the movies that we had both seen, and we had a little key for, like, oh, Dad's seen this one, Ed's seen this one, neither of us have seen this one. And we were going through a lot of those, and then a couple years later, they had the AFI comedy list as well. And I still love going back to that list. Like, if I don't know what to watch, it was great because we would see stuff we would have never otherwise seen. We didn't even like all of it, but we saw a lot of stuff that we never would have seen. And it led to lots and lots of good memories and conversations and just a great way to spend a lot of time together.
Do they have that list?
It still exists.
Every year?
Oh, yeah. You can find that online pretty quick.
And it's
and
just...
now they also, because 100 is so daunting, but they have like the top 10 top 10s as well. So like the top 10 rom-coms, the top 10 westerns, the top 10 sci-fis. And that's like a nice entry level point. Megan and I have definitely picked a couple of the rom-coms off that list. That's been fun.
Is that her genre, her go-to?
Yeah, I would say so. Without getting into it, her research is pretty serious stuff. So she likes to keep it light as far as movies go. And so rom-coms usually fit the bill. Her sister's getting married and they just had a bachelorette party themed with Mamma Mia. So, you know, that's like, that was the sweet spot for them.
I love it.
I was going to say, I got no qualms against Mamma Mia.
Me neither.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
We were watching it the other day because she just wanted to freshen up. And I was loving it the whole time.
That's great. You know, fun fact, I teach... You already knew this, Ed. I teach fitness classes, and my theme this week was Mother's Day, and so it was all songs about mamas. And so I had Mamma Mia in there, and I was trying to tell these women to, like, lift heavy, and, like, I was like, channel your inner Meryl Streep. Channel the fact that you have three men fighting for your love. You're on a Greek island wearing overalls. And that really empowered
me. You took that analogy pretty deep.
Yes, and then there were some... girls in there who are probably 19 who looked at me like, and I said, friends, you must go and watch Mamma Mia. I didn't even tell you that. You should be proud of me.
I'm very proud of you.
I'm spreading the movie love.
That is some deep
cuts.
But
tell Megan I agree with her. Mamma Mia is
good.
A perfect
good,
movie.
Good.
The sequel?
But share.
We saw it in Europe, though. We were having a lot of fun, and so that was really nice. That felt right to see it over there.
That's amazing.
Well, that's good. And how do you and your wife get along with each other's fathers, or specifically your wife with yours? And is he still with us? I'm curious.
Oh, yes. We're fortunate that all of our parents are still with us. I know not everyone is so fortunate, of course.
Yeah.
But we are very fortunate. Our kids still have all four grandpas or all four grandparents. I said grandpas because I didn't know either of mine. So, you know, that was there, but yeah, I would say it's a good relationship. She doesn't like watch movies with my dad or anything. And it's definitely, they've gotten to know each other better over the last 6 years. And I think that they find the ways that they bond and it's fun.
Do you remember the first movie you ever saw with her?
Yes, I do. Well, I remember the almost catastrophic first show I ever watched with her. I had only heard things about this show, and you know, I said, oh, Black Mirror sounds really thought-provoking.
Oh my god.
And That was a mistake. Okay, but I can also go and say what the first movie was. I remember now. It was Big Fish, which is a beautiful Tim Burton movie.
Isn't that a dad movie too?
A tearjerker. But she is not a fan of Tim Burton. She's not a fan of the weirdness. She's not a fan of the fantastic elements.
Sure.
And so I was really worried when I eventually showed her Young Frankenstein. I'm like, I do not know how to pick things that she likes at all. But we have found our Venn diagrams are starting to overlap a little bit more. I'm starting to pick my spots a little smarter, a little better. And some of them are just for me, and that's okay. And I've gotten to know her a little bit better over these years, so that's helping.
Yeah, we've been married for going on 5, known each other for going on feels
9.
Like 10, but I guess, yeah, it would be only 9. And it took me probably a couple of years, frankly, until I felt like I could reliably sort of say, yes, with confidence, I know you will like this one or you won't. Early on, it was a lot of, I think you should try this one. But then, like, for me, the one that always stands out is The Usual Suspects was like the first movie that was sort of high art, you know, was sort of a film nerds type of movie that she genuinely walked away from saying, I really like
I
that
do
movie.
Like that movie.
Give me more of those. And I'm like, okay.
If only they all had twist endings like that.
I know.
Right? It's been hard to find them.
Well, then we watched like Memento.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think of other ones that do that.
Yeah, you didn't like that as much, but yeah, The Prestige, that's how we ended up watching both of those, which is why we like Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, those guys, they get me. I will say probably early on, I was trying to be real cool and be like, yeah, like movies. And so I basically said, whatever you want to watch, Nick, I'll like. And I think I suffered in silence for
Is this is news to me to some degree. I never knew you were suffering. Give us a movie that you feel like you were suffering in silence that I had made you watch.
You're going to divorce me if I say this.
I doubt that.
Star Wars!
She admits it.
If you don't grow up with it, it's hard to connect with it in the same way.
Yeah.
And to be honest, so I know you love like the Marvel films. Here's my confession is like, I've watched so few of them. I'm just going to wait till my boys are older and want to watch it.
Oh, there you go.
Experience it with them for the first time. I think that's a solid plan.
I love that idea. I love that idea for you. And it's diminishing returns right now. I'm hoping that they'll find their own stuff. But as you get later into Marvel, I'm a big Marvel fanboy, but I'm just the last few movies have been lackluster for me. Yeah. I love you admitting about Star Wars, though.
Because not all Star Wars is bad. The ones with the Ewoks, great.
The special thing here, though, is that she specifically made a point of, it wasn't just like, oh, I like all movies or I'll watch anything you want. Star Wars was like a thing we connected on. We like went as an early couple's costume as Han and Leia, the whole I love you, I know, we have tattooed on ourselves from our honeymoon.
Listen,
these are things
listen.
That, and she's refused to admit that maybe she was playing up how much she liked it until we've gotten to this point in our relationship.
Ed, not all Star Wars are good, right?
No, I mean, there's so much now, but there's a lot of goodness in there. It's just not all equally good.
Thank you.
And I would argue I have never said that all Star Wars is good. I just said that I love it all.
You're on the stand now, Nick. Claim all Star Wars are equally good.
Yeah, you must love them all.
I do love them all. That doesn't mean they're all good. That is one of the beautiful things about movies.
You love things that aren't good.
but that's good to know. That's good to know. I now have it in recording. I have this for posterity that,
you
know, you will never be able to once again deny that that you loved Star Wars as much as I did from the get-go.
Well, no one can say that. So anyways, back to Ed. Ed, have you shown, so you have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. 2-year-old probably is still chilling with, like, Baby Shark, I'm assuming. Have you shown the 4-year-old any movies yet? Like, any Disney, anything that, like, you watched as a kid?
Yeah, so last summer we took him to his first movie theater experience.
Oh.
And we took him to see Lightyear, the Buzz Lightyear movie.
Okay.
Because, you know, both boys, we were real good with screen time before the pandemic. Since then, they watch a lot.
That's fair.
And so both boys really like Toy Story, Buzz Lightyear. And so when I saw that was going to be in the theater, I'm like, well, this is the sweet spot. This is just going to be really cool. And we took him there on a rainy afternoon. And there was only like one other family with a young child in the theater too. So it was very good environment for him. And he hung in there so good. I was like so proud of him. He was watching. And then like in the climax of the movie, he realized that the seats bounced. And so he was just like, he was just like, I'm making my own movie fun now. This is great. But no, I would say we've definitely watched the Disney movies are a big, big part of the rotation. Like Winnie the Pooh movies are very, very high. He's actually really taken to Snow White.
Oh.
And so even though we fast forward sometimes through the scary part.
Sure.
He'll like march around the house with something over his shoulder, like saying hi ho and stuff. It's real fun. And so, you know, it's easy to be a Disney adult when you have young kids.
All right. That's just, we have to start working on having young kids so I can be a Disney adult.
All right. Okay. Well, that's very cute. And so you've been with your wife almost 6 years. Happy early anniversary. By the time this comes out, happy late anniversary.
Belated.
Do you have any marriage advice or love advice or things that you would like to share? Or like even things that you found work in your relationship?
The biggest thing that comes to mind is really to embrace like the way you think about family is going to be so different now. Because a lot of the time when I was a newlywed, I kept saying my family and I meant my parents and my sister and my siblings and stuff back in Wisconsin. And she was like, no, this is our family. And especially, you know, having kids really solidified it. But I think she recognized earlier than I did, like she was going to have new boundaries with her parents. I was going to have new boundaries with my parents. And that hasn't always come easy for me. But I think that because I'm a very agreeable person, I don't like confrontation. I don't like saying no to people. But I do think that just practicing with something small so it will be there when you need it. It's like, oh, sorry, we can't make that actually. We've got this other thing planned. And so I think keeping that time that is your time, yours, is important. All the other things that are coming to mind are kind of like the cliche things, but good communication, right? Yeah. It all comes back to communication. Whether you're talking about it as an IO psychologist or as a husband or a wife, I think good communication is number one.
Yeah.
Not that we always are equally good at communicating everything we need to do, but I think if you strive for it, that's the best thing you can do.
Yeah. I think we ask this question a lot of our guests, and spoiler alert, everyone says communication.
Yeah. Some version of.
Yeah. And like we've been there too where you recognize it a lot when you're not communicating, right? So we found that like over communicating sometimes, like the Nick's new thing is being like, what are you thinking right now? And we're trying really hard not to say nothing because you're always thinking something. And so that's a way you can get closer to someone else. Like the other day I was like, I'm thinking about, I don't know, the weather, instead of saying nothing and just like forcing myself to share what's on my mind with him.
Yeah. Or you were pondering something about a neon sign or something. Oh, that you'd seen. Like it was like truly like the most mundane, innocuous, you know, nothingness. But I think it was
sometimes
Dr.
I'll
Stan
just
Tamkin.
Say nothing important. And, you know, whether that's smart or not smart, who's to say? But sometimes, you know, like I've got the viewers would be able to maybe see it. I have these lines when I'm thinking. It's like these lines on my forehead. My wife can tell when I'm thinking about something. She's like, what are you thinking about? And it's not always important stuff. And sometimes I'll just say nothing important. And sometimes she'll press. And sometimes I'm just like, is Chewbacca really that tall? You know?
Yes. I love that. And that's what I was going to say, is it truly could be just like you randomly, your brain had gone off on a tangent and followed a train of thought about movies, you know?
Yeah.
Because you might have seen it like a Pepsi can that had Kylo Ren on it. And then your brain goes to Star Wars and then you get to Chewbacca. Like, you know. Yeah, I love that though. And yeah, it's been an interesting, it's just one new way. We're always trying to kind of find new ways to get to know each other. Like, I mean, I'm sure you've experienced this, Ed, of like you eventually reach a point where it feels like maybe there's nothing more to know about your partner and that can, you know, remove some mystery, remove some love. And this is just one more way of being like, hey, I'm always curious to know you better, even if that means just knowing what your random thought is while you're, you know, looking pensive off in the distance. And then some of the times when I ask the question, it ends up being, you know, like some actual thing that we need to have a conversation about.
Yeah. You're expecting something light.
Yeah. That has happened.
Well,
that has
you happened. Haven't taken the garbage out three times in a row or something like that. Yeah. Another important question in your marriage, Ed. Your wife, is she into IO psychology?
Oh, this is a good one.
No. She's not in the same field. She actually got her PhD in social work, and she works for the medical school. And she does research, long story short, trying to reduce disparities for pregnant women, women having babies. And it's, you know, like a really big issue in this country. Mm-hmm. And so she works with health providers just in a variety of different ways in her team. So it's really awesome work that she's into.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Do you feel like you can, like, do you all shoot the PhD shit? Like, do you have intellectual conversations, or like, do you feel like you're able to share your work with her and she can share it with you?
I mean, there are some times where we'll like see an article on Twitter and it's like, oh, this will help your research, and send it back and forth and that kind of stuff. Or we'll be talking through a problem with a project that she's on. But most of our talking is just about keeping our toddlers alive and how we can keep the spark alive. You know, it's like we want to make sure that we're husband and wife first in the house, you know. And I think that we have a lot of common interests that are science, and we have a lot of common interests that are not science. You know, that's fine.
That's awesome. Yeah, I do not like science.
I was going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is coming a little bit from a place for you of like feeling as, because you do something somewhat closer to social work. You're not a researcher in it, but.
Yeah, I do. I do disability work.
So I was thinking maybe you were like, sometimes you've commented that when we're hanging out with all of my PhD friends that you feel as though you can't either keep up with the conversation is kind of how you've worded it. Or you've literally said, in fact, I think you said at some point in this conversation, like implying that Ed and I are smart. And the implication there is that you're not, which I
think
I categorically disagree with. But
it's kind of like the rock stars want to be athletes and athletes want to be rock stars. Yes. Like, I want to be a comedian. I want to do improv comedy and the stuff that you do. I think that's really, that shows quickness, that shows smartness, and, you know, it shows bravery too. So I've always admired people who get up on stage and do anything like that.
Thank you. Ed, please come on every single one of our podcasts. You can just tell me this stuff all the time. I love it. Also, I would like to say anyone can try. Improv, I think, has helped me in so many aspects of my daily life. Like just today, I gave a training to very many people, and like kind of important people at the college that I work at. And everyone's like, oh my gosh, you're so good. You're such a natural. I'm like, yeah, it's because I improvise first, you know? It's like part of my everyday life of just like, I got to be flexible. I got to be listening, and I have to be adding to the conversation.
Sorry, I was trying not to burp into the mic this time, and then you gave me a weird look, so.
I thought you were, anyways.
No, yes. I think that's really smart. Actually, some of my colleagues just had a training that was improv focused, that was basically thinking about flexibility of thinking, knowing your audience, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love it. And I definitely think that it applies to things beyond laughing, but that's where I love it the most.
Yeah. Well, I like when Nick laughs at me too, the most. I like to think I'm funny.
You are.
Thank it you. Works. Wait, say that again.
You are funny.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. Well, we could go ahead and wrap up here if you'd like. Is there any other pearls of wisdom, Ed, that you want to share with us or our listeners?
Those are the pearls that came to mind. You know, I think that I'm on the spot. I'm sticking with those. I'm sticking with communication, and I'm sticking with appropriate boundaries.
I love it. Yeah, that boundary thing's big.
And not only the boundary thing, because yes, we've used those terms, and both of us are still working on those with our parents in different ways.
Hi, Mom.
But even more so, Ed, your point about like you, even without kids, we are now the new family unit that is the focus, that is the central. Cause I know you and I've had conversations where we both still very much discuss things as like our families are our family. And then we are a partnership of sorts, but yeah, no, I like that. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I like the way you put that.
You bet. It's helped me to think of it in that way. And you know, it's still definitely going to be a process the whole way, right? I'm closer with some of her family. She's closer with some of my family. but it's fun.
Yeah, and we've said this a lot, but just process is another word that stands out to me. Literally anything and everything you're doing in every relationship you have is a process. You don't just like get married and then all of a sudden everything is hunky-dory and it's perfect and that's the answer. So
yeah.
All right. Well, we will let people go to have a little break here and get a word from our sponsors in some cases. But Ed, on the other side of things, what movie will we be discussing?
We will be watching the 1974 Mel Brooks classic, Young Frankenstein.
Lightning Thunderbolts. Do we have a button?
All right.
Come back. In love with movies. Da da da.
And we're back. Welcome back, movie lovers, to In Love with Movies.
That was a break.
Indeed, and it was a long one, and we did many things in between the moments. Yep,
mm-hmm. I feel so rested.
Yes, this is 6 days later.
All right, so this is the movie half of the podcast where we're going to talk about our movie, and today, as we said before we went to break, we are discussing 1974's Young Frankenstein, starring Gene Wilder. Gene Wilder wrote it with Mel Brooks, who is the director, and it's probably most famous for the fact that Gene Wilder's in it, and Mel Brooks directed it, so that's kind of, you know, it's a Mel Brooks movie. It is very much a Mel Brooks movie, but it also is starring people like Madeline Kahn, who played Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Related to James?
I'm honestly not sure.
Do you know Ed?
Ooh, I would have to check that one.
All right.
Google Famous Kahns.
You Google it while we're, because his son is an actor, James Kahn.
Anyway. R.I.P., right?
Madeline Kahn, so she plays the fiance. I know her voice very much so from, she's been in like A Bug's Life, but also she stands out in as Mrs. White in the movie Clue, stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
And she's in so many Mel Brooks movies, too.
Yes.
She was in this one. She was in Blazing Saddles, which she was actually nominated for the Oscar.
I don't think I knew that. Okay, yeah.
Yep. She was in Silent Movie, maybe not, but she was in High Anxiety and also History of the World Part 1. So they did a lot of films together.
Yeah. As I was looking through her filmography, she's in a lot of those kinds of slapstick and or ridiculous types of comedies. What were we going to share, Danielle?
They don't even spell their last name the same way. My bad. But she did die when she was only 57 from ovarian cancer. So that's pretty sad.
Yeah.
She did. That's sad. That is sad. Well, may she rest in peace. That might be why she's obviously not been in as many more recent movies since the 80s or so. Peter Boyle plays the monster. Peter Boyle, I know from Everybody Loves Raymond. He plays the father in that. Speaking of some father love.
Oh, I knew his face structure looked familiar.
Even with the prosthetics, you could kind of tell.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. Marty Feldman is the gent who's the crazy eyes Igor, which is, if you look at his filmography, he's a brilliant British comedian. Gene Hackman plays a great side piece. Cloris Leachman is one that I think most people don't recognize. I wondered if you noticed that was Cloris Leachman.
Why would I know her?
Raising Hope, but she's also just a really brilliant comedian. Female comedian, and you've
I just know the
a
name,
lot of things.
Yeah. Okay.
yeah, and then Terry Garr, I had played Inga, and those are the kind of the big ones, including Gene Hackman. I just threw in there, even though he plays like the blind priest or whatever, as a bit part, just because it's Gene Hackman for gosh sakes.
Maybe not as famous, but I just like to throw Kenneth Mars in there as the inspector as well. He plays the German playwright in The Producers, which is Mel Brooks's first film.
Oh.
And then he also, if you fast forward, I learned this doing my homework for this movie. He does the voice of King Triton in The Little Mermaid.
I did not know that.
Wow.
I didn't. So when I was Googling him, because I was thinking the way that when he has his moment, the inspector kind of has his moment where he comes on stage. It's kind of a.
Is he the.
It's filmed in a. Yeah, the guy who has the arm. The Yep. Mm-hmm.
yeah, yes. So he did a lot of animated work. He was like Grandpa Longneck and all those Land Before Time spinoffs.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That's so fascinating because, like I said, I assumed it was Mel Brooks's movie, The Producers, which is why he had like given him sort of this hero's entrance. But then I was like, other than that, I didn't really know him from anything. Well, now you're listing all these things that I did know him from. I just didn't recognize or didn't make the connection.
Especially, there's a few more in the 70s. I listened to a podcast about this movie where it was his daughter talking about being on the set of this film, and it just sounded really magical. Aww. It was very nice. So he sounded like a great guy.
That's awesome.
That's always good to hear. I mean, that's not often necessarily the case about Hollywood famouses. So,
And maybe, I don't know, I'll ask this right now. Ed, you said you had a little tidbit about why this was filmed in black and white.
Right. So, of course, it's satirizing the old Universal monster movies, right? Not just Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, but Dracula and the werewolf and all these things. And so in 1974, it was no longer cool to do movies in black and white.
Right.
There's a couple different versions of the story, but like Columbia Pictures had signed a deal that they were going to do it, but then they wanted to do it in color. And so Mel and Gene kind of had to bravely say like, well, then we're not doing it with you. And so then Alan Ladd Jr. was the new head guy at 20th Century Fox. And he said, no, this absolutely has to be in black and white. But then, as you know, execs often will try to do, they try and said like, well, we could film it in color and then we'll take the color out. Cinematographer is like, no way. They're going to trick you. They're going to release it. They want the color like now in color 20 years later. Yeah. You don't want any of that. So they did it on like the old film, pure black and white. And it's like beautiful black and white imagery in the whole film. So that was a super mindful choice, which is why I went down a couple Google rabbit holes to make sure that I could broadcast in black and white to you all today. I thought that would be fun.
Yeah, it's awesome.
You went through the same rigmarole to really stick to the art, to commit
precisely
to it.
Precisely the same.
I love it.
It does make this movie feel really, really old, because when you were naming actors, I was like, wait, they're all still, well, not all of them. A lot of them are still alive. And I'm like, oh, it was made in 1974. It is not that old of a movie.
Right.
In my head,
next
these are like
the 50th anniversary. It's so bananas to think that.
Dang.
Because it was the same year Blazing Saddles came out. If you think about it, wow. This is a bananas year for Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The two of the top three grossing films of 1974 were Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein.
Wow.
And you talk about how it's a Mel Brooks movie. It is, but it was Gene's brainchild. He was writing about it on the set of Blazing Saddles. And Mel's like, hey, what you writing over there? And he says Young Frankenstein. And at first Mel's like, there have been too many Frankenstein movies.
Sure.
And he says, no, but this is like the grandson who is ashamed of his family history, but how would he respond if he learns that he inherits the estate and he finds out he could do it and he slowly but surely realizes it's in his blood and he has to do this. And Mel's like, that's interesting. Let's talk. And they had all these writing sessions and it turned into a real true collaboration for the two of them.
That's fantastic. That's a great story. I did not know, like, obviously they both got the writing credit. I didn't realize the hows and the whats on that. That's
also nominated for the Oscar, those two, for adapted screenplay.
Oh, wow. Didn't win, though.
There's a reason Mel Brooks, like, is a name 50 years later. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. He was king of box office, you know what I mean? And at the same time, you know, you had, like, your, even before Superman's and Spielberg's, like, he's been a powerhouse for a very long time.
Yep.
I'm curious.
Like, when he was making all these, like, it's got to be in black and white, Blazing Saddles hadn't come out yet. So his other two movies, The Producers and The 12 Chairs, were not commercial successes.
Sure.
And so then in February of 74, Blazing Saddles comes out and is like the number one movie. Then everyone's like, oh, you can do whatever you want. But his secret to appease people before he actually had that clout and that power was like, take Blazing Saddles, which we're not talking about, but he was like, Gene Wilder, the curly hair guy, you got to get rid of him. Mm. And, you know, the language, we got to change this. Oh, you can't punch a horse. You can't do all these things. And he's like, okay, it's out. It's out. It's out. And then he took none of their notes. So he would agree with them. And then he would do nothing and they would forget and say, okay, it looks good.
The power.
That's hilarious. That's so funny to me. That's the way the studio system worked. I have before we get to the Danny's Dingle. I'm curious.
No,
that's okay. That's okay. We were talking so much about the black and white. I wonder if you know this, because I noted that the sound was kind of muted, almost like old timey black and white film. And I wondered if you knew that was something they did intentional. Like, did they distort it somehow or anything?
I mean,
like
they
that?
Did a lot of intentional things. They did a lot of things with like special effects to make it that style of like drawing the lightning and all those kinds of things. A lot of the original set from the Frankenstein movie was the same stuff that they were using.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
They found this guy, Ken Strickfaden, who was not credited in the original Frankenstein. He was just keeping it in his garage for like 40 years. And then he finds this guy, and if you look at the opening credits, it says special thanks, Kenstrick Fadden, and they had the original stuff from the classic, you know, 1931, whatever it was, film. And so it feels old because it is old. It's like they're using that ancient equipment on the set, and it just adds to all of it.
That is very cool.
I'm getting very romantic about this movie. It's a fantastic, not just movie, but movie making story.
Yeah.
And I will say, before I let Dani get into her dingle, just in case, this is an excellent opportunity. I love hearing all this story. I love hearing your passion and your love for this movie. Everyone is allowed to have different feelings about movies. Young Frankenstein.
Like I said, I was terrified Megan wasn't going to like this movie. We watch it every Halloween now, which is great. But I was mentally prepared for her to not like it.
It is my personally least favorite Mel Brooks movie. Like pretty easily, handedly for me. And it's just not one that I think Danielle and I had particularly strong feelings one way or another for, frankly. So we will get to be the tempered, but if you're a listener, for example, and you fully agree with all of the passion and all of the love and you know, infectious nature from what Ed's saying, then God, awesome, great. If you watch this movie and you lean a little bit more on some of the criticisms that Danielle and I might levy, that's also fine. The movie is subjective, and your love of it is perfectly merited, no matter where you stand.
I do want to say, though, and this happens almost every single time I watch a movie and then I listen to someone talk about it, so you guys are right. Hearing the way that you are able to talk about this movie makes me see it in a different way. And we haven't even gotten there yet.
Yeah, and then that's just another layer of like all the craft going behind it. Like, I'm even learning these things, and it just gives you a whole different respect for the thing that you just watched. This piece of art has another layer to it. But with that all in mind, I'm going to let Dani give us her summary of the movie.
Time for Danny's dingle.
Baron von Frankenstein. A box? What? I'm confused. The box? I don't understand. It's Frankenstein. Does the brain actually do that? Transylvania. Igor. Walk this way. Inga. Oh, secret lair. Is Gene Wilder wearing mascara? Conveniently, a large man is murdered. Brain depository. Frankenstein. Nope. The monster is born. He's a good guy. A scary guy. What? Sedative. Sounds like. Abnormal. Girlfriend, fiance. Lots of infidelity going on. Blind man? A musical act. The monster is taken. And then the end. Everyone is love. Large penis joke. The end.
That is, in fact, literally very much how it ends.
That was not the best.
Bravo.
Thank you.
I enjoyed that. It was really hard for me to not, like, laugh. I was containing my laughter. Like, I'm on the set of the movie right now. I got to stay quiet. Mel Brooks handed out white handkerchiefs for people to put in their mouth when they were going to laugh. And he would look around and he would say, like, oh, it's a room of 100 white handkerchiefs in their mouths. It's going to be a hit. It's going to be great.
That's
and
awesome.
I felt like that in that moment. I loved your little dingle.
My little dingle.
As little dingle as opposed to large bonspooker.
So I think we forgot to do our love story.
No, I was going to have that after the dingle. We usually end up, we try to do the dingle first, but we always do it wrong and we forget. Well, we want to do the love story last so we can then move into.
Great, let's do our love story.
Yeah, all right. Your love story is.
So, Ed, well, we talk about like the first time we saw this movie.
Uh-huh, and yours is?
Yesterday. Yep. Shockingly. And I will say, being in the comedy world, this is a movie that is referenced a lot. So it is very good to actually see the context surrounding a lot of the one-liners that I've known for a very long time. And I do have a lot of friends who are like, you haven't seen Young Frankenstein? And now I can say, thank you to Ed, I have. So last night was the first time I saw it.
This movie, and specifically just really Mel Brooks at all in the 70s and 80s, defined a certain kind of comedy, and that sort of absurdist comedy, for sure. My love story with this is I had seen it before once or maybe twice. I remember that my brother got a like Mel Brooks DVD box set at some point in the past because Blazing Saddles, Spaceballs, and then Young Frankenstein was part of it, and I watched it as a part of that at some time in the past. So not that exciting either. But, Ed, we understand that you have a particularly touching love story with this movie, so why don't you share that with us and our listeners?
I'm glad you think it's touching. when I was a young kid, you know, there's... When you have kids, it's like, when do I introduce a film that I love to my kids? So like with Star Wars, like my kids have seen lightsabers, but they haven't seen Star Wars. You know?
Sure.
And so my dad knew that it's not like a laugh out loud, always super hilarious movie, especially to a kid. But he wanted me to have an appreciation for what he was satirizing, for what he was actually trying to make fun of. And so when he saw that I was into monsters, he's like, oh, well, you should watch Frankenstein with me. You should watch Dracula with me. You should watch these old Universal movies. And then when I was like 8 or 9 years old, eventually seeing this, might have been 10, I don't exactly know when, but I had this knowledge base that I was able to see like, oh, I see what they're making fun of, the blind man, the hermit in the woods. Oh, I remember that part. Oh, he didn't throw the little girl down the well. And I understand. And so all these little references meant more to me as opposed to just watching it like, why are we watching a movie in black and white? He really set the stage for me because he loved Mel Brooks. And not all Mel Brooks is appropriate for 9 year olds. And, you know, most of the scenes in this movie can be okay for a 9 year old. And so he really set the foundation for me to like the movie a lot. And I don't know that I loved it as a kid, but I, you know, when I was put on the spot as a 19-year-old or something, what's your favorite movie? That's the movie that would come to mind. If you ask me now, it's probably my favorite movie. I don't think it's the quote-unquote best movie, but it's my favorite movie.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, that nostalgia. And also, I feel like movies like this, I think about movies I saw when I was young, like, sometimes it's a funny laugh because you're a kid and they're doing slapstick. And then you get older and it's a funny laugh because they said something inappropriate. It's an innuendo that you didn't get the first time around. So I think this is probably one of those movies that it can be entertaining because it's monsters and a little bit of slapstick and not just absurdity. But also the schluge, what is it?
Von Stucker?
Von Stucker.
Yeah, the dick jokes.
Yeah. Yeah,
he's going to be very popular.
So we have, I'm sure we have some opinions about that, but I loved where you started with this, Ed, because you just gave exactly what I think we may have talked about before, but I suspect it might have been the case even if we hadn't, about your background with the original monster movies that this is a send-up for. And, you know, there's this sort of rule around satire that to be a good satirist, you almost have to know the original material that you're satirizing better than, say, like the people who made the original. Like, you have to know it in and out. And I think you have to know it to some degree to appreciate it, because I had this note in my stuff to ask you about this specifically, because for me, Spaceballs is probably my favorite Mel Brooks movie. And because we've already in this conversation on the today's episode discussed Star Wars, like, that's why. Because I know Star Wars in and out, but I'm also perfectly capable of recognizing the absurdity of some of it and, you know, am able to have a good laugh at it. So I love Spaceballs because Spaceballs does to Star Wars what this is doing to those Universal monster movies. However,
so I think my counterpoint to that would be like Spaceballs is a wonderful satire of, you know, not only Star Wars, but Alien and Star Trek and all these different kinds of things. But it doesn't have the emotional through line that I think this movie does have.
Oh, I would agree.
And I think that this is like more of an elevated satire. I think that this is the Gene Wilder sensibility coming through. Like, he really wanted to make this more of a sequel than a spoof. In a
sure.
way. And I think that like the music is beautiful. I don't remember the music from Spaceballs. The story of like the monster is sad. You know, I don't remember being moved by Spaceballs or Men in Tights or some of these other very funny movies. And I'm willing to say that this is not Mel's funniest movie, but I think it's his best film.
I might be willing to concede that. I would definitely not argue that Spaceballs is a better film. Like, I categorically would not. The only point I was looking to make is because, like, you talked about the specific scene from the well. You talked about the blind man in the woods. These are things to me that you said, you specifically said something to the effect of, they're not just random, like, people he encounters to you. I don't think I've ever watched an entire Universal Monster movie ever. Literally any one of them. Not Dracula, not Frankenstein, not Bride of, and none of the above. So to me, as a viewer, it is just a random scene with some random
person.
Like,
if you watch his movie High Anxiety, which is not my favorite, but Alfred Hitchcock loved that movie. He said, have no anxiety about High Anxiety when he saw it in a screening. And so he really wanted the approval from Alfred because he doesn't want to just make fun of the source material. He's doing his tribute to the source material with poking fun at it. And so I think that you're right. He is an expert in, you know, Mel's kind of an interesting guy because he can hit you with like the lowbrow crotch jokes and everything else, but he'll also hit you with like, unless you have read this obscure Russian novel, you're not going to get it. And so I think that he plays to his intelligence, but he also plays to the masses. It's a very tricky balance. And I don't think a lot of people take that approach, but I think that he really does, whether it's the 2,000-year-old man or anything that he's ever done.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, and comedy is just so subjective. And Mel Brooks has to be doing something right to literally still be creating. Did you watch History of the World Part 2? Like, he's
still
creating.
Yes, I'm glad we're not reviewing History of the World Part 2, but there were a lot of parts that I really did love.
Me too.
But
it there
was some wildly inconsistent.
We would agree with that.
I would say, okay, if they come out with season 2, I will watch it. But did it need to be a 4-hour series? Could it have been a 90-minute movie that would have just been way funnier? I think so, right?
For sure. So, yeah. I mean, I think that there are some laugh out loud parts of this movie. I don't think there's as many, like, as, just in my opinion. Again, everyone has their own. I like Robin Hood Men in Tights. That one's one of my favorites. But I've never seen Blazing.
Fantastic.
I've never seen Blazing Saddles or Spaceballs or any other one. So that's on me.
Yeah, Blazing Saddles, you've seen scenes of. It's not one I always go back to. Spaceballs is on our list. And Ed, if you want to pick that for some future appearance, if we don't turn you off too much from this conversation, you know, maybe you can be the excuse that I finally get her to watch it. But I love your point about Mel Brooks manages to walk that tightrope to the point where he includes sort of both sides of the really highbrow comedy and the really, really lowbrow comedy. And I think the interesting thing, anytime I watch it, and this includes Spaceballs, includes History of the World, and includes Young Frankenstein, I think a lot of times it's like the jokes for me are always pretty like hit or miss, but when they hit hard. You know what I mean? Like he's Babe Ruth, you know what I mean? Like he swings it a lot. He doesn't hit every single one of them, but when he hits it, boy, that goes out of the park. And
when
then
he connects, you just like you are holding your stomach in pain laughing so hard, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I laughed way too hard when Igor says, walk this way.
And it's such an old joke, it's perfectly placed, right?
It is. And it's like you've seen it in a bunch of movies before, a bunch of movies since. It is, but it hits. And
walk this way.
Famously inspired Aerosmith to name their song Walk
No.
This Way.
No, are you kidding?
Yeah, they were taking a break from recording. They watched the movie and they laughed so hard. They're like, we've got this riff. This works with it. Let's go.
I did not know that. That's so fantastic.
That's amazing. And by the way, Aerosmith is on their farewell tour right now.
That's true. That's true.
So I have some questions about this movie, and I'm sure, Ed, you could answer them. Or maybe Nick. Maybe I was paying attention. So the opening is somebody stealing a box from a skeleton who doesn't want to let it go. And then he sits in the back of the professor's Frankenstein's classroom. And then the professor goes to Transylvania. So I think I got, where did the box come from and why is he going to Transylvania? I got lost. Did I miss something?
All right. So The box at the beginning is not my favorite part of the movie. I'm like, what is going on with that? Truly. Mm-hmm. But I had assumed, I don't know why you would be buried with your will in a box, but I had assumed the will was in there. They read it. He brought it saying, yes, you have inherited this. Evidently, there was a long scene with a lawyer that just wasn't working. Mm. There was like a 3-hour rough cut and a lot of that stuff just hit the floor. But yeah, I think it was just, there were no other surviving relatives. And so they went down the list and they found, I always want to say Frederick. They found Frederick in the States. And I think that's what was in the box, just sort of explaining the connection between the two of them.
Got it. I just didn't understand how he was in the classroom. Did someone tell him to go to Transylvania? Yeah. Or did that part get cut? Or was I not paying attention?
No, I think that's what
it was, the man in the mustache with the back, you know, who brought it there. And it's funny. It reminds me of when I showed this movie to Megan. I'm kind of notorious for not giving a great pitch to movies. Also, she didn't know it was going to be a comedy, but then it like cuts to Gene Wilder saying my grandfather's work was doo-doo. And she's like, this movie's hilarious.
I did think that part is very funny.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Gene Wilder's performance, he goes from level-headed to insane so well.
Yeah.
I wrote
better than anyone I can think of.
I wrote, Gene is wild, perfect for this role.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the only time, because he was in a lot of comedies around that time, around that decade or two, but like the only movie I think that truly exemplifies that skill of his is Willy Wonka. Yeah. Like, and it is that Willy Wonka is like kind of the same character in a lot of ways in terms of how he plays.
Those are the two.
Yeah.
I don't know that I could choose. I have my bias choice, but objectively, I think those are the two.
Yeah. And then who's his fiance? Oh, she funny.
Elizabeth?
Yeah.
Taffeta, darling.
Just very, very dumb. Like, I love you. And I didn't know he was going to Transylvania. I got lost. And so I was like, why is there this heartfelt goodbye? Is she going to come back? And then she came back. So thank goodness we got a full circle with Elizabeth and her it's the schlong. I think the setup of this movie, there must have been a lot more cut because I do think it's like, Professor, which by the way, I was enthralled by his lesson of him putting the thing on the back of the guy's neck. I literally wrote down, wait, is this true? Like if you put something on the pressure points, you can't have reflexes.
No, that's the
bit. Okay.
The bit that he was paying the actor.
I would call that a colorful exaggeration.
But the whole time I was like, oh my God, I never knew that. That's so cool. So then he's on a train, which I thought was very funny. They showed Passage of Time, like New York, Transylvania.
Yeah, I did. I literally, when it said he was like coming into New York, I was like, hold on a second. There's an ocean. Are they going to comment on that? And it was like, nope, just a different train. And now all of a sudden, Transylvania.
With a very similar couple arguing about,
Yes, but it would just, I thought to myself, I was like, I wonder if they're speaking like actual German or some real language. And if so, are they literally saying the exact same words? Because that's something that I feel like Mel Brooks would do too.
Yes. And then we are introduced to Igor, who is hysterical because Frederick Frankenstein. Igor. And I looked at Nick and I said, does that guy really look like that? Because I thought that was like amazing practical effects, but that's his face, huh?
Yeah, there's some conflicting reports as to why, but basically genetic condition that, you know, it might have been hypertension that exacerbated it. He also smoked 5 packs a day and died tragically young. That didn't cause the eyes, but he had some health problems.
Yeah.
Well, I think he's a really good actor. I think he's arguably wonderful. The funniest one in this film because he, with the hump, and he's just...
And the hump changing sides. That gets me every time. That is one of those
The story behind that is that he did it on set without telling anyone, and then they noticed like a day or two later, and Mel thought it was so funny that he wrote it in, and it was just beautiful.
I, at one point, because then there was another scene where he, like, they were... creating the monster. He's upstairs. He's like saying, he's shouting, come down here to be safe or whatever. And then the guy suddenly appears. And there's more than one time where he like does that sort of thing. And that seems to also be the times when the hump switches. I had a thought to myself. I was like, is there a bit in this that I forgot where it's actually two different people? And it's like, I don't know, conjoined twins or something. That it's like, there's not one Igor. It was so good.
That's hilarious. Frau, what's her name?
Frau Brücher. Thank you.
Brücher. I can't say her name. Man, she has watery eyes the whole movie. She's crying the whole movie. She's a very intense Frau.
That's Cloris Leachman.
She's super intense, man. But did you notice?
So fantastic in that. I think she's like loosely based on a Alfred Hitchcock character called from a movie called Rebecca.
Okay.
That won like Best Picture in 1940. Huh. So it's kind of like a mysterious housekeeper, very creepy vibes, in love with the previous house owner, that kind of a thing. And she's an Oscar winner in her own right too. And so she brings it. She brings it in History of the World and some of his other stuff too. Amazing. Actually, for 1974, I thought all three of the women just really killed their roles. I thought it was really fun and funny.
I agree.
I think they crushed it, but the writing was not so good to women.
Not.
I think it was of its time, for sure. But
yeah, I was thinking that Ilga, she got done dirty a little bit. She was kind of just the like, but I'll talk about that later when I'm going down my list.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a good segue. I was trying to let you have it. No, okay, go ahead.
I want to talk about Frau.
Okay.
Who the horses are afraid of. Did you notice at one point she's like, stick close to the candles, and she's walking them through the house, and the candles are not on.
I know. I that took me until adulthood to notice that, but it is delightful.
Is there anything you know about that, or they were just like, this is
stupid? I think it's just absurdist. I think that you just like, the candles aren't even lit, man.
And all the other candles in all the other rooms are very clearly lit. And then she makes out with the picture.
You have to stay close to the candle.
Then she makes out with the picture of Gene Wilder. That was very funny. The bookcase scene, that is very much a comedy. Like, that is classic comedy. Like, pull the candle, put the candle, pull the candle, yeah, the back yeah. and forth. Very, very funny.
And then with his lips smashed, he's like, whatever you do, do not replace the candle.
That could have easily been an Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, right? Mm-hmm. That scene was taken from that time.
Yes. And I do think, I like that you said that was all the old stuff for the original Frankenstein, because I do think there was something magical about when they found the like secret lair. Like, it just felt...
I love
authentic.
How they did the voiceover of the original movie, and it's just, yeah, you feel like, oh, it's happening here.
Explain that.
Yeah, talk about that.
What was the voiceover?
Oh, when they take, I don't remember the name of the actor that played the original Dr. Frankenstein, but they have him talking through his creation, and Gene is like sort of recognizing and imagining his grandfather in this laboratory. And maybe that's why, even if you didn't notice it, it like really makes it feel like, ooh, there's something special with this lab here. And if you rewatch that scene, they've got the original audio from the original Frankenstein there.
Dang.
See, I think I thought that voiceover was Gene, but I thought to myself, it sounded different. And that makes sense layers. Yeah. Layers upon layers. So this is why I always like these conversations too, because again, a movie that I like didn't maybe not enjoy as much. It's when you learn these other things, and that's frankly where the depth and the brilliance of this movie comes from, is when you have 100%. That additional context.
And like, that's the kind of stuff that my dad and I will like notice on rewatches.
Yeah.
Right. When he moved me down to Florida and we didn't have any furniture, we were just sitting on the floor, we popped in this movie, right? Two Christmases ago, he and I both got Mel Brooks's book, Mel Brooks, All About Me, for his birthday and him for me for Christmas. You know, it was just like, my mom was just seeing this happen and just like, you know, her heart's all aflutter. And so it was, it's great. Like, rewatchable movies, sorry for the trademark thing if there's the podcast people that are listening to this, but Yeah, it's just every time you watch it, you pick up these new things. And I've picked up stuff preparing for this podcast episode today. It's been wonderful.
That's awesome. Yeah, and we always learn more about the movies, especially from someone who like loves it a lot. And that's why the movies are the movies that we love. Like Christmas Vacation, I've watched it 700 times. I can tell you, like, explain the rule of threes in comedy and like explain all these different like intricacies because it's something that we love. So I'm glad that you are sharing this movie with us.
And that is another movie, by the way, that like I have had lukewarm feelings on, but because it's gotten played over and over again in my house, the more times I watch it, the more appreciation I have for it. So,
I can't remember. Why do they need a large person? Why does it have to be a 7-foot person?
Oh, it simplify everything. The veins, the organs, everything. It's just like you're not getting in with like all these fine little details of a petite person. You want large, exaggerated features.
Ability to, like if you're going to tie off a piece of string, let's say, because you're tying off, you know, cords and whatnot. Well, you want them to be larger string because that's easier.
But the brain is the same size.
Apparently. I mean, that. I love the brain depository with like leave after, because that is just so, that is like quintessential Mel Brooks absurdism.
That was very, very funny.
Where like the joke that's not even somebody looking to camera, but the joke itself is breaking the fourth wall. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah, I thought that was hysterical. I also love that that very large man conveniently dies. In that tiny little town of Transylvania. They're like, oh, perfect. Let's find this guy. And then he breaks the brain of the whoever. It's supposed to be a brilliant doctor. And they get Abby
Hans
Normal.
Del Brook. Yep.
Yeah. Is it Mel Brooks? Was it supposed to be a Mel Brooks?
Del
no,
Brook.
Hans Del Brook might have even been a real person.
Oh. I thought he was just putting his name in there. And then there's an anti-science mob. And I was like, uh-oh. Is this... The 40s, the 70s, today.
Or the 2020s.
What a time to be alive.
And then I think the brilliance of Mel Brooks is like in the dumb character things, like the hand man, the arm man. Oh. That's not even the funniest part. The funniest part is that he puts, what are those things called? A monocle on an iPad.
Monocle over the iPad.
That is a good bit.
And they never call it out. They're just like, here it is. Very, very
yep,
dumb.
That's just perfectly normal.
And then Monsters Alive. Oh, the fact that they're playing charades, even though he's about to like suffocate. He's like, three words. Sounds like bed. Okay, set. That got me. That tickled me a little bit.
Set a give.
Very funny. So this little girl scene, I thought it was just a sweet little scene in this movie, like to prove that he is not a monster. He's just playing flowers and saying, I love you to this flower and not hurting the girl on purpose and flings her back in her bed.
Which is also funny.
In a reference to the original Frankenstein?
Yeah. Unfortunately, in the original, the monster throws the little girl down the well.
Got it.
And so when she says, oh, no more petals on the flower. What else can we throw down the well? And he like looks at the camera like,
yeah,
maybe. But he decides not to. And you're right. He's showing his humanity. And so that was 100% a nod to the original for sure.
And the same thing you say for Gene Hackman's character.
Yeah. So that was actually a scene from the sequel Bride of Frankenstein.
Okay.
But it's this very touching, beautiful scene in the woods where he meets the blind hermit. And Gene Hackman, of course, not known for his comedy acting.
Right.
At the time, he was like superstar, but he played tennis with Gene Wilder. Mm. And he's like, man, I got to get into a comedy. I got to lighten it up. I'm doing all this heavy stuff. And he says, well, I do have this role. And he actually, I believe, did that role for free. Yeah, he just was like, as a favor, this sounds like so much fun. Let's do it.
That's fantastic.
I will say that role, I know it's supposed to be sweet. It's a little creepy.
In a modern...
I just thought he was coming on to Frankenstein. He's just like, please give me a person. And I was concerned that he was going to be a little touchy.
I thought to myself, I was like, oh, is this like a Catholic priest joke? Was that like a thing that was being made fun of in the 70s? Because I thought that was very much a 2000s realization, at least.
But then he ends up just wanting to feed him soup and cigars.
Yeah, I don't think that was there, to be honest, but yeah. I can understand why you might see it that way, but absolutely die when you see the hot soup poured in his lap and the wine goblet being smashed and his thumb being lit on fire. And I guess, you know, I was going to make espresso was like an ad lib that they had to cut away because all of the people were laughing too hard. So it goes to black like really quick.
That's fantastic.
That is hilarious.
That's really fantastic.
Gene Wilder's, Frankenstein's turn in this movie is very interesting to me because he's becoming his grandfather. He's like, okay, I created this monster. Then he goes into the room and he's like, whatever you do, do not let me out of this room. And then the second he steps foot in the room, he's like, oh no.
He's such a coward. I don't.
Yeah, that was actually surprising because I was like, oh, he's finally being brave. He's got this.
Oh, really? No, because that's been like a bit that I feel like has been done in different versions. So when he kept making such a big deal out of like, no matter how much I complain, no matter how much I scream in terror, do not let me out of this room. That was what was telling me, oh, he's going to get in there and immediately turn around and cry like a baby. Yeah. Which he did.
But then he becomes, I wrote down, he becomes his mom. He just like turns into, he's like, this is my baby.
Oh, the monsters. Yeah.
And then he's
this
like,
this is a mother's angel.
Is that what he says? Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and then of course, like he says, oh, you're my baby, but I will exploit you and put you in front of an audience and make you sing and dance.
Yeah. It was interesting. So he said, I'm scared of you. Wait, I'm your mama. Wait, I am Frankenstein. And then.
Yeah. The part that never worked for me. And I think it's just like goes to show how much it was about Dr. Frankenstein's ego was he was like, don't blow this for me. Right. He wasn't showing like it's you're safe. Right. You're not in danger. You know, it's just the light. He says, you fool. What are you doing? Yeah. Do something. And I was just like, oh, this is going to go very badly.
I had a thought while I was watching that, because this has been one of those movies that for me, the few times that I've seen it has been mostly forgettable personally. Like I always forget about a lot of the scenes because they don't have that context to me. I remember basically the scenes in the castle before they create the monster, and then I remember the scene where they reveal him and kind of do the song and dance. I think the song and dance part to me, I wonder if it's meant to be, and you might know, a nod towards like the original King Kong movie, because it felt like, oh, we've got this monster and, you know, it's actually a gentle creature, but now we've put it in this context and all of a sudden it goes.
It is. And, you know, there's actually a story that there's, again, different versions of. It's like Who Survives Tells the Stories.
Right.
But that Gene and Mel got into a really big argument about that scene. And he says, we're going to have him tap dance at Irving Berlin. And Mel's like, no, people aren't going to believe this. It's two bananas. It's all these things. And Gene's like, no, I really need this to be in here. It shows how sophisticated he is. And it shows, you know, like how he's not just alive. He's doing all these things, which if you think about it, they start booing him, not because, you know, it's like a monster. It says, oh, you can't really sing and dance. Not that they brought lifeless matter back to life. The scientist would be very impressed if he wasn't dancing. But they got into this big fight. And then Mel was kind of like, okay, it's in. And Gene's like, why'd you put me through all that? And he's like, well, I wanted to make sure you really believed in it. I wanted to make sure that you didn't just like give up on it because I knew it probably wouldn't be right. But if you believed in it that hard, it probably is right. And it turned out to be one of the more memorable scenes in the film.
Yeah, for sure.
I like waver, to be honest, in that scene between like it's heartwarming and then it's hard to watch. I don't know. Personally, I work with people with disabilities. And so the way that he was singing it, I was like, oh, that part was hard for me.
That was another one for me that much like the sort of thinking there might have been a Catholic priest joke, I thought to myself, like, I can't quite tell if this is some sort of intentional thing, because if it is, then that's frankly offensive. But I couldn't tell if that was what it was meant to be or if it was just like, how else do you play that other than, you know, someone who mm-hmm. is, you know, he's clearly supposed to be kind of mentally impaired in some degree, but.
Yeah. Or he's evolving, or it showed like that he had worked a lot with the. So that's why I was like, oh, they're very close. They've been working on this for a long time. Or I'm just like, oh.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
The only other part that I think I got really turned off at the end, and this is just coming from a female perspective, this is a movie written by a lot of men. The fiance just, I don't know, both the women at the end are like, I'm so happy in this relationship because of the big dick. And like the first time the monster is with Elizabeth, mm-hmm. she's kind of like, oh no, oh no. And it was a little, okay, I'm going to say this. It was a little rapey to me, that scene, watching it.
Yeah, I'm comfortable agreeing with you on that. Right?
I don't want to like shit on your movie.
I do not look forward to chatting about with my boy.
For sure. It's the one when you said you were talking about your dad showing it to you or whatever because most of the scenes are safe. I thought to myself, like, yeah, there's really only one scene I can specifically think of that I would not really want a kid to watch because it would just have all these sort of. And it's not even graphic by any means, but it would create questions of like, daddy, what is he doing to her? Why is, you know what I mean? And it's like, you
did. Yeah, and like in a modern context of consent, it doesn't work.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think that if you talk about what ages well and what ages poorly, that age is the worst.
Yeah. Agreed. I agree. And that part, I was like, ugh. But then, I mean, they do come back to like, she keeps going back to him and eventually obviously marries him. And that's the whole thing of it. But yeah.
Which is another part of me though, that like, I have two minds of that because, okay, so she comes back to him and it, you know, it shows that she's, you know, got agency and she's making her choices, but it's like, it is the crass joke. It's just it's a low brow joke. And you have to decide whether or not it's an offensive joke to you that essentially having a big dick is sexually satisfying to all women and being sexually satisfied is the most important thing to all women, which, you know, is lowbrow and may or may not be offensive, but yeah.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's like, I was thinking about, is this a love story? And I think it's a love story between Frankenstein and his monster, and the women are kind of just like added into it. And like the women, clearly Elizabeth does not like the doctor. I don't even know why she's marrying him because she has money. He doesn't. I also think it's wild that like she gets scared and then she has highlights all of a sudden. She's got those two.
I was able to at least say like, well, that was, I knew because it was
Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah. Got it. But okay. I have one final, since we're towards the end of the movie, we did go from beginning to end.
Which we sure did.
Least favorite thing.
You won it.
Ed, what do you think about the ending of him saving his monster by switching brains? Just in general.
Well.
Or combining
brains? I think that it's finally him recognizing like he had a responsibility to this monster. And that if this monster was going to have any kind of good life at all, this was going to be the only way he was going to do it. And, you know, it doesn't matter that the science isn't good. It just matters that he was willing to sacrifice it all. You know, Igor says, you know, there's a chance that you might both lose your lives. And then he does that joke with the violin, right? And there's a lot of jokes with music and everything in this movie. And so I really just think it's the most redeeming thing he does in the whole film.
Yeah.
A very solid point.
I agree. I expected, again, because this is my first time seeing this movie, I expected him to have the monster's brain, and he didn't. He only had the monster's dick.
Well, that's why he said, not a second more, not a second less, right? He knew it was only a little bit that he was giving him. And I think that at earlier watchings, I was like, is he the monster now? Mm-hmm. What's going on? Mm-hmm. But, you know, just glaze right over that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it could be done more seriously, but the way that you know that we're doing it, like there is the serious note of like, he's making the sacrifice. And then the actual punchline is like, we're trying to rush to the end of this movie. So we're going to make a dick joke. And, you know, we get there and it's,
what did you get out of this situation of Von? What is it called?
Von Schluger.
Danny, I do have a question for you about like sort of the whole way the film was done, right? Yeah. So you've got a background in comedy and in many ways, this is different from a lot of Mel's movies. Because Gene even said, like, I'll do this movie with you if you're not in it. Because Mel winks at the camera too much. Mel is, like, too silly, breaks the wall, fourth wall too much. Like, Igor does it, and he's allowed to because he's this kooky character. Mm-hmm. But everyone else plays it so straight. Mm-hmm. And I've heard other comedians and other comic actors say, like, even if you're doing a super broad, silly character, it's not going to be funny if you're playing it for laughs. You have to play it straight. And Gene Wilder has talked about how he was trained as a dramatic actor, and people just sort of laughed at what he did. So if the situation is silly enough, what is your thought about, like, playing it silly or playing it straight, playing it for laughs? Why does that work? Why does that not work in this movie?
That's a really great question.
Very deep. I like it.
There's actually there's a whole book that I read about it that's, like, kind of the philosophy behind, like, improv and where it started. And it's called Truth in Comedy. And it's, like, the same thing where you can attest to, like, when I first started out in improv, I was like, I have to say this thing and I have to try to be funny. But the funniest things in life or the funniest scenes are actually the ones where you're just being honest and you're trying to be as sincere as possible. And it's just, like, the situation surrounding it or the consequences of it are actually funny. And I think a lot of that is because, like, comedy is just like this movie is, like, satire. It's a slice of life that we're just trying to, I don't know. Like, I have some anxiety. I put a lot of that into my comedy, and I'm just very truthful in my scenes. And what comes of it is an absurdist situation or a situation that is one step removed from real life, but it has the sentiment of this is a real character, this is a real relationship, this is a real location. And so I think you always need that one person that's going to be the straight man. You always need that one person that's going to be the wackadoo, and that was Igor, like you said, in this. And he was my favorite character because I like stupid. Like, the funniest things to me in this movie were the stupid things. But there's also, like, I don't think it would be a funny movie if everyone was just playing a caricature of them, the character, because then it's not the real movie. It's not, like, you wouldn't take this seriously. I think Mel Brooks does that really well. I haven't seen a ton of his stuff, but, like, I truly did enjoy History of the World Part 2. I'd say 75% of it.
You enjoyed more of it than I did, but yeah.
Like, I thought some of the funniest scenes in that were, like, the Jesus ones.
Oh, yeah. And they went at it a lot of different ways, and it was really fun. I would say the first episode, it was, like, finding its feet in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But, like, the Jack Black musical number as Stalin, like, absolutely
yes,
killed me.
Crushed.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I wanted so much more of that and did not get more of that. That's okay.
Yeah, instead you get Nick Kroll singing about cabbage.
Yeah. No, I appreciate your answer. That makes a lot of sense, that especially early you try to be silly and it's not going to work as well. But Gene's, he's had his own problems in his life, right? He actually wrote a book too called Kiss Me Like a Stranger, and he talks about it. The whole frame of the book is like him talking to a psychiatrist. Like, that's how he's talking about his life. And he's gone through some things, and he was never, like, a truly happy person. But, like, as they were finishing this movie, he turned to Mel and he's like, can't we do some more scenes? Can't we write some more? And he's like, no, it's done. And he said filming that movie was the happiest in many ways that he had ever been. He just didn't want it to end. And they all really loved each other. They were great friends. They met, actually. Mel Brooks was married to Anne Bancroft, the famous actress. And Gene and Anne were doing a play together. And that's how they met. And he said, oh, I'm working on this thing. The producers, you're going to be in it someday. And it was like over a year later, but then he was in it. And, you know, it's just, these folks really loved each other. I think they loved being on the set. And I think that not all sets are going to be that way, but this was one of those wonderful happenstances when everyone really came together and liked being there. Mm-hmm. It's pretty great.
Yeah. And I think it's maybe because they were so, like, you could tell that they put a lot of themselves, like you were saying, into this role. Like, Gene Wilder is a mad scientist, I think, in real life. Like, you can tell that he is conflicted in real life. The fact, I've only seen, I think, two movies of his, and the other one's Willy Wonka, and like you said.
Oops. He did some great ones with Richard Pryor, too.
Yeah.
You know, Richard Pryor, of course, co-wrote Blazing Saddles with Mel Brooks.
I guess I have to watch that, huh?
That'd be another good one for you.
Yeah, buckle in for that one.
But yeah, I do think
speaking
also...
Speaking of some racial jokes that have not...
Yikes. I do think, like, a lot of comedians are the saddest people in the world. And yeah. I think that just goes to show that, like, the conflict inside of them is so true and real that when it comes out, it's their release. And to the world, it might be absurd, but to them, it's like, that is their reality. Yeah. Like, Gene Wilder was, Robin Williams. I think one of the funniest men that ever lived. And
whoever
he was
lived,
so,
for sure.
So tortured.
Yeah, and Mel has this interesting quote about what is funny, and is like, if you get a paper cut on your finger, that's a tragedy. But if someone else falls into a manhole cover and dies, that's funny. And it's just like, what, you know, it's this fine line of, you know, comedy coming from conflict, comedy coming from like scary places, but the unexpected happening in those moments. And so I think that this movie, you know, it paved the way for so many like horror comedies too.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't think we would have What We Do in the Shadows without Young Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, it's just, we're better off for it. And it's amazing to me. I didn't know right away that Gene Wilder, it was like his brainchild that Mel was reluctant to do. Cause I always, and I think he really wanted to do his own stuff, but it was this wonderful collaboration. I wish they would have done more. Like, they did The Producers, they did Young Frankenstein, they did Blazing Saddles. And then Gene kind of did his own stuff for a while, which I think Mel had supporting roles in a couple of it, but yeah, they remained great friends, even if they didn't make more great art. So what can you do?
I have learned a lot from this.
It's been an excellent conversation, as it often is. but I suppose we do need to, all good things must come to an end. So we will need to give our heart ratings and our would you renew your vows. So Ed and listeners, reminder that this is where you're going to give a 0 to 5 heart rating. That's meant to be a more or less objective view of sort of the quality of the film. And then the sort of would you renew your vows is just, you know, upon this rewatch for you, did it still hold up? Would you choose to watch it again, given the opportunity? Pardon me, in the future. I think we probably know where Ed's going to go, at least with that second one for sure. I'll go ahead and say, like, this conversation has given me a further respect for it to the point where I feel more comfortable giving it a slightly higher rating than what sort of my sort of gut reaction was. Because again, trying to be objective, trying to give them the respect.
That was my goal. When I heard it, I was like, I'm going to nudge them in the direction of watching this in the future.
I think I am going to give it a 3.25 out of 5 for me. There's room for growth. Some things don't hold up as well, but it gets a couple of extra bonus points too, just for the like anything that has contributed to the overall art form that you just can't argue against that. Like, you get more credit for that from me personally. In terms of renew my vows, probably not. Like, you know, I'm not mad that we watched it again, but upon my rewatch, it's about what I remember from the last time. Like, I'll forget parts of it a week from now, and if I never watch it again, that's okay, but I will have the things that do stick out to me, the things that do mean something to me going forward. Danielle?
I was gonna give it a 3.5, only because as a woman, it's not the best representation, some of the characters, but I do have to respect it for, like you were talking about, Ed, like the foundations of comedy. Like, there are so many elements in here, and I like dumb stuff, and there's a lot of dumb stuff in here, so I can appreciate it for what it's done. I will not watch the whole movie again. I think I would rewatch some of the scenes, especially because, you know, in an improv show, a lot of times we get Mel Brooks suggestions, we get Young Frankenstein, we have to be these characters, so, like, it is the foundation for so many other things, like you were saying. So I'll YouTube walk this way.
You need to be more familiar with it for your own comedy.
I would recommend watching the outtakes, and you can just see what a good time they're having. Like, Gene breaking character all the time. He was so serious in this movie, but he is just laughing his head off the entire time. You know, it's very hard to be objective about this film.
It's fair.
Because my subjective is a 5 out of 5. I would say my objective is a 4.9 out of 5.
I love it.
I will say I looked, it's 8 out of 10 on IMDb. So, like, you know, 4 out of 5 is really kind of where the consensus seems to be.
Yeah,
so.
And it's, you know, talk about those lists. It's number 13 all-time comedy, according to American Film Institute, and that's not why it's special to me. But it's, you know, it's definitely one that comedians and people who love comedy, I think, should see at least once and see if it's for them.
Yeah, and it's a study, if nothing else. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And you know, I don't think that it's the one you should pop in if you're going to be looking to laugh the whole time. I totally get that. Mm-hmm. But I think Blazing Saddles could be that, as long as you have a stomach for, like, okay, they're talking about racism, but the bad guys are the racists.
Yeah.
And so I think if you frame it that way, that's why Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles is ranked higher. But I also think, like, The Producers makes fun of Hitler, like, so fresh after World War II, all those things. I'm going on and on. I could go on and on about it for sure. But yes, I will renew my vows. Everything Mel Brooks done in his 95th year of life is a gift. I will continue to be a Mel Brooks completionist until I die. Everything I can, I'm just going to absorb and enjoy, hopefully.
I love that.
I love that a lot. And again, maybe Blazing Saddles, maybe you can help me get her to watch Spaceballs. Producers is one that we have seen, and I think would be competing with Spaceballs for me,
yeah,
as one of
the Producers, of course, was turned into the great musical. Young Frankenstein didn't do as well, but it was also turned into a musical. I saw that with my family in Chicago, and that has great memories too.
Aww.
There's songs like with Elizabeth singing "Please Don't Touch Me," there's songs with Frederick and his dream of joining the family business. It's just a great show that is not a perfect show, but I've never seen Young Frankenstein in the theater, but seeing it there to, like, laugh with people who, you know, seeing a comedy with other people who are laughing is a different experience.
For sure.
But yeah, it's out there if you want to look for it.
Well, and you said that next year's the 50th year.
50th anniversary next year.
So I bet it's going to be in theaters.
And Young Frankenstein. So perhaps next year.
Yeah.
I guess we'll go on the internet with records of how we think about Blazing Saddles.
I would enjoy that. I would totally do that for the 50th. And it's been a while since I saw Blazing. I've seen it more often. I do remember there being lots of racial jokes, but like you said, I remember it also always being like, it's kind of like winking at the, like, we're saying things that are...
We're not talking about that movie, but some people laugh at that movie for the wrong reasons at the wrong times. And so there's all of that, but it's a classic.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, with that, movie lovers, we're going to let you go. But before we do, Ed, is there any place that our listeners can find you on the internet to hear more about your thoughts on psychology or your love of Mel Brooks?
Yeah, I mean, you can find me on Twitter. That's how Nick and I connected, @Hanson_PhDad.
Cute.
But otherwise, yeah, I'm just you know, teaching psychology down in Florida, so if you want to take my class, you can, but otherwise I'll see you on the interwebs.
All right, very good. And that will be on our notes as well. Danny, where can the listeners find our podcast?
At the letter N _ love with no underscore.
Sometimes I like throwing this at her because don't normally. Let me try this again. Danny, where can our listeners find you?
Great, yes. You can find me at DannyMiami4. I post all my shows. I post all my classes that I teach. I post my crossover class /shows. follow me there.
All right, you can follow our podcast at In Love With Movies. That's the letter N, Love With Movies, all spelled out, on Hive, Instagram, and Twitter. Hive. We're still on Hive. We'll see how long that lasts. And then you can find me at Nick Loves Movies. That's NIC Nick, LUV Love, on basically everything, including Letterboxd. And we'll see you all over there.
Wait, I love you, Nick.
I love you, Danny.
And we love you, Ed.
Love right back at you.
And we love you, listeners. Thanks for joining us.
Bye bye.
In love with movies. Da da da.
I'm more than happy to do that, even though Megan enthusiastically supports me sitting in on things like this. Like, I'll get into it. Breaking down movies, talking about movies has never been her, what draws her to movies.
Sure.
Same.
I was just going to say.
Here I am.
That's why we have a love half of the podcast.